you for joining us for the Srimad Bhagavatam class. I'll be attempting to speak on the ninth canto, chapter 20, text 13 through 15. I'll chant texts 13 and 14. Shri Shakuntala Uvacha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Shri Shakuntala Uvacha Vishvamitratmujai Vaham Tvaktva Menakaya Vane Vidaitad Bhagavan Kanvo Virakim Karavamate. Translation. Shakuntala said, I am the daughter of Vishvamitra. My mother Menaka left me in the forest. O hero, the most powerful saint Kanva Muni knows all about this. Now let me know, how may I serve you? Purport. Shakuntala informed Maharaj Dushmanta that although she never saw or knew her father or mother, Kanva Muni knew everything about her, and she had heard from him that she was the daughter of Vishvamitra, that her mother was Menaka, who had left her in the forest. Interesting. Text 14. Ashyatam hyaravindaksha grihyatam arhanam chana bujyatam santi nirvada usyatam yadirochate. Translation, O King, with eyes like the petal of a lotus, kindly come sit down and accept whatever reception we can offer. We have a supply of Nivada rice that you may kindly take, and if you so desire, stay here without hesitation. Text 15. Shri Dushmanta Uvacha. Upappanam idam subru. Jataya kushikan vane vaye svayam hi vrnute rajyam kanyaka sadrisham varam. Shri Dushmanta Uvacha. Upapanam idam subhru Jataya kushikan vaye svayam hi vrnute rajyam kanyaka sadrisham varam. Shri Dushmanta Uvacha. Upapanam idam subhru jataya kushikan vaye svayam hi vrnute rajyam kanyaka sadrisham varam. Shri Dushmant Uvacha. King Dushmanta replied, Bananam, just befitting your position. Idam, this. Subhru, O Shakuntala, with beautiful eyebrows. Jataya, because of your birth. Kushika Anvaye, in the family of Vishvamitra. Svayam, personally, he, indeed, Vrnante, select, Ragyam, of a royal family. Kanyaka, daughters, Sadrisham, on an equal level. Varam, husbands. Translation purported by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Translation. King Dushmanta replied, O Shakuntala, with beautiful eyebrows, you have taken your birth in the family of the great saint Vishvamitra, and your reception is quite worthy of your family. Aside from this, the daughters of a king generally select their own husbands. Purporting her reception of Maharaj Dushmanta, Shakuntala clearly said, Your Majesty may stay here and you may accept whatever reception I can offer. Thus she indicated that she wanted Maharaj Dushmanta as her husband. As far as Maharaj Dushmanta was concerned, he desired Shakuntala as his wife from the very beginning, as soon as he saw her, so the agreement to unite as husband and wife was natural. To induce Shakuntala to accept the marriage, Maharaj Dushmanta reminded her that as the daughter of a king, she could select her husband in an open assembly. In the history of Aryan civilization, there have been many instances in which famous princes have selected their husbands in open competitions. For example, it was in such a competition that Sita Devi accepted Lord Ramachandra as her husband and that Draupadi accepted Arjuna. And there are many other instances. So marriage by agreement or by selecting one's own husband in an open competition is allowed. There are 8 kinds of marriage, of which marriage by agreement is called Gandharva marriage. Generally, the parents select the husband or wife for their daughter or son, but Gandharva marriage takes place by personal selection. Still, although marriage by personal selection or by agreement took place in the past, we find no such thing as divorce by disagreement. Of course, divorce by disagreement took place among low-class men. But marriage by agreement was found even in the very highest classes, especially in the royal Kshatriya families. Maharaj Dushmanta's acceptance of Shakuntala as his wife was sanctioned by Vedic culture. How the marriage took place is described in the next verse. Umayana timirandasya gananjana salakaya chakshurun militam yena tasmai shri guruve namaha. Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kitamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Jagalatru Vistragriva Sanduveva Chapatitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivas Adi Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Ram Hare Hare. King Dushmanta replied, O Shakuntala, with beautiful eyebrows, you have taken your birth in the family of the great Saint Vishvamitra, and your reception is quite worthy of your family. Aside from this, the daughters of a king generally select their own husbands. Hare Krishna, welcome everyone. We have an interesting discussion today, interesting topic. It's not one that I might have selected of my own accord, but we have the discussion of different types of marriages in the purport here. And we may question what is the relevance so much in the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is elevating us beyond the worldly atmosphere and the likes and dislikes of this world to direct our vision towards the Param Satyam. But we see in this purport, Srila Prabhupada took very much careful time to educate us not only in terms of the absolute, but also in terms of the relative. There's a nice, very nice verse that's mentioned in the Ishopanishad. Do you remember that verse, Giridhari Prabhu? Related to this certain point of discussion. It's a nice verse. It says, Vidyam cha vidyam chayas tad vidho bhayam saha avidyayam ritum tirtva vidyayam ritam ashnate. Only one who can learn the process of nescience and that of transcendental knowledge side by side can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death and enjoy the full blessings of immortality. So Srila Prabhupada took the opportunity to educate us both about the transcendental reality of yukta, param satyam, but also the context in which that realization can grow and develop, and that is the Vedic culture. So Prabhupada is emphasizing here Maharaj Dushmata's acceptance of Shakuntala was sanctioned by Vedic culture. In other words, if something was not sanctioned by Vedic culture, that should not be done. The Bhagavad Gita mentions the demons, they don't know what is to be done and what is not to be done, but the devotees or the suras, because they always meditate on the lotus feet of Vishnu. Om Tad Vishnu Paramam Padam Pashanti. Sada Pashanti Suryo. The devas, the demigods, they're always looking to the lotus feet of Lord Vishnu. They're looking for the Lord for guidance and for instruction and for the process, actually. So the Vedic culture is exactly that. That is how Krishna plans to educate all of the conditioned souls who are making the, you know, arduous sojourn through material nature, through this material manifestation. They've fallen from their eternal position in the kingdom of God, and now they are, you know, absorbed in a dangerous, scary, fearful situation of this material world. Sometimes we say that when a child is born, there's no instruction manual, right? The parents like to say like that. But in the material world, when one takes birth in this the womb of samsara, of prakriti, also there's no, it's very dark. The soul is immediately bewildered. And he has to learn little by little who he is, what the nature of this world is. So that's the Vedic educational syllabus. I was just sharing with a friend how I've seen from Gurukul students, they're maybe 5-year-old students and they have a picture. And in crayons, they've drawn the highest philosophy. It says, okay, here's the Brahma Jyoti, and here's where Goloka Vrindavan is. This is the material manifestation, and this is Mahavishnu, and these are the universes. It's a child's picture, but it's actually encompassing the highest spiritual reality. So even our 5-year-olds, they have the knowledge that goes, the real education, which is beyond what any university or PhD student, you know, one book or one purport of Srila Prabhupada gives so much more real knowledge than what anyone can learn in the materialistic education, because they won't understand who they are. So they'll be acquiring more and more piles and heaps of illusions which accentuate their confusion about life. But Krishna says, Brahmakshara Samud Bhavan, the Vedas directly emanate from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So they're his direct injunctions. And the conditioned soul is benefited. He does well to learn primarily. First, he has to learn the Vedic system, the Vedic injunctions, and to follow and ultimately to try to impart and share that. That's the duty of the Brahmins. Therefore, the Brahmins are so worshipped in Vedic culture, actually. Even Krishna himself worships the Brahmins. The Brahmins are mentioned as the mouthpiece of the Supreme Lord. Krishna takes more satisfaction in eating food through the mouths of the Brahmins than he does his own. So that is because they have the sacred duty to, for the whole material cosmic manifestation, to benefit, share the particular process by which the material manifestation can serve its actual purpose, which is to bring the conditioned souls back to Godhead. So one such aspect here being discussed is that of marriage. Different types of marriage are sanctioned in the Vedas. And we had a discussion point a little bit yesterday in terms of the Manu Samhita. This kind of ancient text, but I actually found some of it. I was reading some of it. It was actually quite fascinating, quite amazing, actually. And this is where we hear these eight different kinds of marriage. And they're recommended for the different castes. The Brahmin generally follows one of the upper four types of marriage, where the husband chooses the groom, or he gives away his daughter, like that. And then there's types for the Kshatriyas and Vaishyas, and also for the Shudras and the Asuras. So here we're hearing about the Gandharva marriage by agreement. And it also may remind us of another type, which is called the Rakshasa marriage, which is also, we find in the Bhagavatam, of the kidnapping, according to the system, kidnapping a bride. And this is actually the marriage that Krishna preferred in his pastimes very often. This is a very adventurous form of marriage. And Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, I am adventure. So we can expect, so part of the point is that the real attraction in marriage is because there exists the real eternal spiritual marriage of Krishna. So marriage in this world, it tends to bring a lot of charm and attention and very consuming affair. And that is okay, but we can know that the real marriage to meditate on is the marriage of Krishna, the marriage of God's marriages. Here we're trying to come to the standard, we're trying to imitate God's marriages. But God's marriages are, if you meditate on God's marriages, you become enlightened. If we meditate on our own marriages, we'll likely become more entangled. So Krishna's marriages are inspiring, even for renunciates or brahmacharis, because any of the Lord's activities, they display his unlimited aishwarya. Aishwarya samagrasya viryasya yashashashriya gyanavairagyayos chaiva sanam bhagami tingana. The six opulences of the Lord are exemplified in all of his pastimes. It's just a question of whether we have the ability to see it and appreciate it. Otherwise, people can read a whole book, a whole Bhagavatam, but not be attracted, because we're not actually meditating properly on the position of the Lord. Therefore, we see that the 10th canto comes a little later on, once we've understood the position of God, his unlimited aishwarya or opulence, virya, strength, yasha, fame, jnana, knowledge, vairagya, renunciation, Shri, beauty. So this is Krishna's the real Prabhupada says the cynosure of all eyes, or the real reservoir of pleasure. That's Krishna. And we can't find that in this material world. So we happen to have some of these books describe Krishna. So this is a little bit of a last minute class. I'm sorry I didn't wasn't able to prepare so much, but it is quite relevant to hear a little bit about Krishna's marriage, and that will give us some substantial purification and also attraction to this spiritual reality. So the setting, we're going to hear a little bit about Krishna's marriage with Rukmini, and the setting itself is quite capturing. There's drama, there's suspense, there's intrigue, all of the things that we're looking for actually we can find in Krishna's pastimes. Generally people think they have to go on to CBS or HBO to find some worthwhile subject matter, right? Those are the TV stations, if you're so fortunate that you don't know. But those are, again, it's a stinging, backbiting version, because you might get your suspense, but you're going to get smashed by material infection when you see that type of drama. Everyone's in drama. They want drama from the ER. There's a whole field about either scrubs. And wow, it's so exciting to be in the medical field in a hospital, see people dying. So people are after that drama. They need to get that rasa somewhere, ananda mayobhyasat, or we could say the karma program or the karma channel, law and order. See how people get what they deserve. But these are simply pale reflections. And anyone who's gotten the beginning of taste in spiritual life, then they immediately lose interest. This was always described as one of the first steps in your spiritual life. Throw away your TV. Then you can start to make progress. As long as you have a TV, your spiritual life hasn't begun yet. That was, you know, as we were coming to that position. And that is most likely true. Of course, we can use it to watch Prabhupada videos, as we say. But the point is that Krishna's pastimes can actually fully satisfy us. So Rukmini heard about Krishna. She never saw Krishna, right? Just by hearing, that itself is a very big point. Similarly, we have in Krishna Lila, the wives of the Brahmins. Just by hearing about Krishna, what happened? Their heart became totally attracted. So we have that same, that is an instruction. Sometimes you think, oh, I can't see Krishna. If I saw Krishna, then I could get attracted. But no, Prabhupada always emphasized you see through your ears, through the hearing process. So that is what happened just by hearing about Krishna. That's how powerful Krishna is. Krishna is non-different from topics about him. So she became completely infatuated. She sent a Brahmin with a message to Krishna. And it says, after hearing Rukmini's statement, Lord Krishna was very much pleased. He immediately shook hands with the Brahmin and said, my dear Brahmin, I'm very glad to hear that Rukmini is eager to marry me, since I am also eager to get her hand. My mind is always absorbed in the thoughts of the daughter of Bhishmuka, and sometimes I cannot sleep at night because I am thinking of her. So Krishna is also, we shouldn't think that the only emotional pastimes happen in the material world between conditioned souls. No, Krishna also has relationships, and his are purely spiritual with his own internal potency. Again, that's the real romance. How much romantic films, books, not everything. Everyone's so absorbed. They're obsessed. And what does it also relate to? The prince and the princess. It's very often, this is the epitome of that wow, the princess was rescued by the... So what do we see in Krishna's past? That is the, it's called the archetype. That is why it's prevalent here. I remember as a child with I have a brother and sister. Very young, what would we play? The king and the queen, or the prince and the princess. Just almost subconsciously, almost without even hearing. That's like an impression that's in the soul. Because as above, you know, so below. So that those impressions, they can't be taken away. It's a reflection of the spiritual world. So therefore, everyone, yeah, let me just hear about that prince. The ladies especially, sometimes they love that, the young ladies there. Krishna's the prince. Krishna's the prince of Vrindavan. He's the original prince. If you get attracted to Krishna, then you get to experience unlimited eternal ecstasy. But if we get attracted to some mundane, pale reflection, fleshy, mortal prince, then you stay in samsara. So it says here, yes, King Bhishmaka was arranging this wonderful event here. In the Vedic system of marriage, the bride's father receives a large party of the bridegroom and accommodates them in a suitable place for 2 or 3 days until the marriage ceremony is performed. So there was many, many thousands of men, prominent kings and personality, including Jarasandha, Dantavakra. It was an open secret that Rukmini was meant to be married to Krishna, but that her elder brother Rukmi had arranged her marriage to Shishupal. There was also some whispering about a rumor that Rukmini had sent a message to Krishna. Therefore, the soldiers suspected that Krishna might cause a disturbance by attempting to kidnap Rukmini. Although, even though they were not without fear, they were all prepared to give Krishna a good fight to prevent the girl from being taken away. So Krishna's pastimes are so enchanting that even he's God, so much drama is there in his pastimes. Why? To attract us. If Krishna was just God, and he just plopped down in his universal form, then where is the chance to really awaken that? But no, he acts just like a human being. Therefore, they're thinking, oh, but Krishna might come. That's the actual mystery of Krishna's pastimes. They're very mysterious. His human-like form. So meanwhile, Rukmini was expecting Krishna to arrive, but when neither he nor the Brahmin who took her message appeared, she was full of anxiety, began to think how unfortunate it was. There is only one night between today and my marriage day, and still neither the Brahmin nor Shyamasundar has returned. I cannot ascertain any reason for this. Having little hope, she thought that perhaps Krishna had found some reason to become dissatisfied and had rejected her fair proposal. So, I am not so realized, and the way I'm able to narrate this, there's a certain degree of lightness, but actually these pastimes are so deep that it's actually a very profound meditation. And Krishna's pastimes are the completion of all of these different emotions that we can try to experience in the material world. And that's what, I don't know about you, but we're always hankering for that. We're always hankering, where can I find that rasa? Where can I get that taste? But if we carefully go through the shastras, that's why Vyasadeva compiled these, we can experience that which we can't get in the material world. So, Rukmini, full of anxiety, saw the Brahmin messenger. Krishna, the super soul of all beings, could understand Rukmini's anxiety. Therefore, he sent the Brahmin inside the palace to let her know that he had arrived. So, then there's a particular procedure where Rukmini goes to the temple of Durga, goddess Durga, that the family deity is worshipped there. And she had instructed that this is the time when you can take me away. So she offers her prayers to the goddess. After this, she comes outside. Rukmini caught hold of the hand of one of her girlfriends, which was decorated with a jeweled ring, and left the temple in the company of the others. All the princes and visitors who came to Kundina for the marriage had assembled outside to see Rukmini. The princes were especially to see her because they all actually thought they would have Rukmini as their wife. Struck with wonder upon seeing Rukmini, they thought she was especially manufactured by the Creator to bewilder all the great chivalrous princes. And there's a description of her extremely exquisite beauty. Her beauty was specifically tended to attract the attention of Krishna, however, not for the princes. You can say that the princes are embodying the tendency to try to exploit Krishna, Krishna's energy. But actually, Krishna's energy is meant for his enjoyment. So they're thinking, no, this is for us. So similarly, without this Vedic culture and education, then the living entity thinks all of this is meant for my enjoyment. That's the material, egocentric conception of life. Forget about Krishna in the center. We're in the center. Life is about me and my pursuit and my conquest for happiness, either on an individual scale or a collective, as a country, whatever, as a planet, even, you know. But no, the Vedas say, Aham sarvasya prabhavo matta sarvam pravarte iti anta bhajute iti matva bhajante mam buddha bhava samanvitaha. I'm the source of everything. Those who know this, they're absorbed in this gratitude, actually. Their hearts are always absorbed in me. So that is what Krishna wants to offer to all of us. And to conclude, the chivalrous princes assembled there were so overwhelmed by Rukmini's beauty they became almost unconscious and fell from their horses and elephants. Full of lust, they hopelessly desired Rukmini's hand, comparing their own beauty to hers. Srimati Rukmini, however, was not interested in any of them. Her heart, she was simply expecting Krishna to come and carry her away. As she was adjusting the ornaments on a finger of her left hand, she happened to look upon the princes and suddenly saw that Krishna was present among them. Although Rukmini had never before seen Krishna, she was always thinking of him, thus she had no difficulty recognizing him amongst the princely order. Krishna, unconcerned with the other princes, immediately took the opportunity to place Rukmini on his chariot, marked with a flag bearing the image of Garuda. He then proceeded slowly, without fear, taking Rukmini away, exactly as a lion takes a deer from the midst of jackals. Jarasandha, who had many times experienced defeat by Krishna, wrote, how is this? Krishna is taking Rukmini away from us without opposition. What is the use of our being chivalrous fighters with arrows? My dear princes, just look, we are losing our reputation. And then he speaks some unkind words to Krishna. And then we see that there's a very fierce battle ensues. Krishna defeats all the princes and takes Rukmini home to Dwarka. So that is what I could share on this text and purport today. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for your tolerance. If anyone has anything they'd like to share, contribute, thank you.
And can you explain again about, you said something about Jesus.
Jesus?
Yeah, you said.
I didn't say anything about Jesus this class.
Some marriage, something?
Sorry?
Regarding marriage, I think.
I didn't say Jesus.
And Bible, something you said.
There's different types of marriages. They're meant for different castes. Some are more practiced by Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, or Shudras. This is called the Gandharva marriage. There's also the Rakshasa marriage. I'm not sure what, maybe I wasn't clear enough.
Srila Prabhupada explained here in purport, there are 8 kind of marriage.
Yes.
So, did you do some research? What are those?
Yeah, I have it here, if you want to know the marriages. Okay. There are 8 marriage rites used by the 4 castes. They are the rite of Brahma, that of Daiva, the Rishis, that of Prajapati, that of the Asura, that of Gandharva, that of Rakshasa, and that of Pisakas. The first 6 are lawful for a Brahmin. The 4 last for a Kshatriya, and the same 4, excepting the Rakshasa, for Vaishya and Shudra. So this Rakshasa is authorized for the Kshatriyas. But three of the five are declared to be lawful and two unlawful. The Pashaika and Asura rites must never be used. So, Hare Krishna Guru, he's asking about the eight types of marriage. We're hearing about King Dushmanta, who married Shakuntala, and the marriage that he performed was among the Gandharva system, but we narrated Krishna's marriages are much more exciting than any of our marriages. We think our marriages are going to be so exciting and big and grand, but no, actually, if we get attracted to Krishna's marriage, we go back to Godhead. If we get attracted to our own marriage, then we tend to stay in the material world. So we read how Krishna captures Rukmini, and now we're just doing some Q&A. He's asking, what are these different types of marriage? So, the gift of a daughter after decking her with costly garments and honoring her to a man learned in the Veda and of good conduct is called the Brahma rite, whom the father himself invites. The gift of a daughter who's bedecked with ornaments to a priest who duly officiates the sacrifice is called the Daiva rite. When the father gives away his daughter according to the rule after receiving the bridegroom a cow and a bull, that is the Arsha rite. The gift of a daughter by her father after he has addressed the couple with the text, may both of you perform together your duties, and has shown honor to the bridegroom is called in the Smriti the Prajapatiya rite. When the bridegroom receives a maiden after giving as much wealth as he can afford to the kinsman and to the bride herself according to his own will, that is called the Asura rite. The voluntary union of a maiden and her lover, one must know to be the Gandharva rite, which springs from desire and has sexual intercourse for its purpose. The forcible abduction of a maiden from her home while she cries out and weeps is called the Rakshasa rite. Now this is interesting. The eighth and the most base and sinful rite of the Pishakas. When a man by stealth seduces a girl who is sleeping intoxicated or disordered in intellect, that is the most base and sinful rite of the Pishakas, which I think is a lower class of living entities. Is that okay for me? This, I'm just finding out about this myself, so... Yes, yes. That's a good point. So, let's see in the purport here. Prabhupada says, still, although marriage by personal selection or by agreement took place in the past, we find no such thing as divorce by disagreement. Of course, divorce by disagreement took place among low-class men, but marriage by agreement was found even in the very highest classes, especially in the royal Kshatriya families. So in Vedic culture, it's interesting, in Sanskrit there's no word for divorce. It's not actually a function. This Vedic culture is very strict that the marriage for the man, that is his assist in his spiritual life. And for the woman, that becomes her duty, her sacred duty to serve the husband. So nowadays, the divorce is a very common thing. But even I was reading that even in Western culture, a few hundred years ago, divorce was considered a very sinful thing. It wasn't a widely accepted thing, you know. And now in devotees also, it's quite common. So traditionally, there is no actual scope from the Vedic perspective. At the same time, we see that there is scope for, and Prabhupada has said, and Chanaka Pandit said, we were just hearing Prabhupada's lecture, that if the wife is unagreeable and there's no mother in the house, then one should go to the forest. So what there is scope in Vedic culture is this progression of ashrams, brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas. So there is an evolvement. It's not that you stay married forever, actually. That's not either the case. The case is that it has a purpose, a function, and then life is short. One has to prepare themselves for the future. That's the whole point of the Vedic system. And that means gradual detachment. Janasya moham yamaham mameti. The eye and mind, it becomes particularly enhanced in the Grihastha ashram. I have to worry about so many things. So my time, my consciousness is very limited to really get absorbed. So then later in life, that is provided for. Is that okay, everyone? Thank you. Anything else? Anyone else would like to? Question, comment? Giridhari.
Hi, Krishna. Thank you for reading pastimes and explaining. It's nice to hear. I'm wondering about the point you made about the from the Isha Upanishad, something that I think about often. Mm-hmm. Like it says, I was reading the purport here. It was saying, the point of like the material side of like maintaining a balance of spiritual and material. Mm-hmm. It's like basically just to maintain a healthy body and mind. So for the purpose of self-realization, like since we're not completely transcendental, like if we try to like stop all material functions, our body starts to deteriorate, and if we're not completely transcendental, we're just kind of like deteriorating basically. So that's like the purpose of economic development within the context of like spiritual cultures, like the purpose of like for sadhana, bhakti, we need to stay healthy. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that. Also, just my thoughts go to like preaching in the West. From my observation in like New Zealand and Australia, they have a lot of successful programs where they have like restaurants and ashrams and farms and things like that. And it's a lot of like material things. But it's attractive to people when it's engaged in service of Krishna. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about that for the sake of preaching and having the facilities to attract Western people.
Yeah, the Yukta Vairagya principle is what we hear again and again as highlighted, how to find that balance. That's individual. Everyone has a different adhikar or position by which they could utilize that principle. And what's right for one person may not be right for another. So we need to understand for our standard of where we're at, to what degree is utilization of material things facilitating our bhakti, and to what degree is that diminishing our bhakti. So it's not going to be the same for everyone, or even every community, it will be different. Ultimately, the principle is that accepting those things that can be utilized with detachment, seeing everything as the property of the Lord, and favorably, if those conditions are there. But that takes a lot of maturity, actually. Otherwise, in the name of Yukta Vairagya, we can do so many things that this is actually for Krishna's service. Do we know what is actually, do we know what will actually enhance our bhakti? Otherwise it can become atyahar, or lolium, over-endeavor. The material, the products of our materialistic society, they're generated, they're created from a materialistic, egocentric point of view. You know, something like Facebook. You say, well, I'm using it in Krishna's service so I can connect with my friends. But how am I connecting with them? You know, to what degree am I detached from it? am I seeing it as Krishna's energy, and is that actually favorable? Because Facebook is meaning it's all about me. Let me post my pictures, my news feeds. Let me let everyone else know who I am and what I am, how great I am. So that's actually antithetical to the practice of Krishna consciousness. So that's my perspective. That's one angle on it. It can be used to connect with others, but are there other ways we could connect with others? Maybe in a more service-minded way. So to expand the preaching, that's why it's such a careful line. The Acharya actually spells out, okay, this is your degree of Yukta Vairagya. Prabhupada, the Acharyas, they're qualified to actually say, yeah, this is... Prabhupada didn't even want a telephone in the temple. Prabhupada would write letters. He said, Prabhupada, we have this telephone. It's so easy, it's so practical. I said, no, if they get that, they'll just speak Prajalpa. He didn't want a telephone in the temple. Because they put Yukta Vairagya, use it, find out what's going on. No, Prabhupada. So the Acharya, he designates, okay, this is the material atmosphere. You know, therefore, it's so amazing the role of the founder Acharya, or the Acharya, is that he, according to time, place, and circumstance, he establishes what is required for spreading and practicing Krishna consciousness. And it's definitely beyond our adhika, our level. We would think of something totally different. So we want to, as far as possible, hear from those who are directly in line with Prabhupada's vision. That's one practical point I could suggest. We can have a lot of ideas, but we may not be at the point yet where we're able to really implement or understand the implications. But when we hear from directly from what Prabhupada has instructed and his very loyal and empowered disciples, then we can, you know, take up these things in a protected or authorized way. Param, you want to say anything about this verse? Vidyam cha vidyam cha yas tad vidho bhayam saha avidyayam ritum tirtva vidyayam ritum ashnute. One who can learn the process of nescience and that of transcendental knowledge can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death and enjoy the full blessings of immortality. So some material knowledge has to be there. If he has to know both. If he only knows one, he doesn't know how to operate in this world. If he only knows this world, then he can't transcend. So some degree, my angle is a little bit more on the cautious, a little more on the less side. But there's many, many creative ways we can branch out. We just want to be careful. And time tells. Many devotees had so many ideas. We want to see what is the sustained, what's sustainable over a long time. And sometimes some of the ideas that went way out, they may not have worked out. And for some people, those that tried to maintain a very traditional, maybe they weren't able to maintain that. So a personal program is best, I think. Yes, sir.
Maharaj, the same traditional program.
Very traditional.
What's the name of Maharaj? Guru?
Trivikram Maharaj.
Trivikram Maharaj. So let me share with you. Maharaj has the same traditional program from last 40 years. He wakes up in the morning, he comes to Mangalarti, he do the whole morning program, he do the Bhagavatam, he go for preaching, he come back in the evening, he do Sandhya Arati, he give the class and chant his Gayatri. That's his whole program for 40 years.
Very simple.
And he says that he's so much attached to this program, he can't give up.
Yeah. So it seems like, it may seem, as Kali Yuga goes on, it may seem more and more like this is outdated. Just think we're just in the beginning. Oh, Prabhupada's program, morning, evening program. You can see a few hundred years from now, it might seem, oh, that was back in the 1900s. That was in the 2000s. Now it's 25, 34. We're much more advanced. But Prabhupada said, no, this is the standard program. This will give you what you need. So some devotees, they catch on to that instruction like Maharaj. And then they're protected. And I asked him, And he said that safe and sound, I know what I'm doing. Others can do what they want, but I have faith in this. I can rest assured that Prabhupada's program, I'm not going to be led astray. So that's his conviction, and he's doing. He said, 76, and he's very strong and empowered.
If you really want to know Maharaj, you should hear his class, how strong Brahmachari is.
Yeah.
Just by doing morning program and evening program. It's such amazing.
Nice Gita discussions every night. Okay, it's 8:30. Thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Nitai Gaur Prema.